Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Whitney Economic Update Call. The Hancock Whitney Asset Management Group provides this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Whitney Corporation or any of its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockwhitney.com. On today's call, we have Chief Investment Officer David Lundgren, Chief Investment Strategist Paul Teton, and Investment Directors Richard Chauvin, Jeffrey Tengis, and Greg Hudleski.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to this month's call. For this month, as we've done, I think, for the last 5 years, this is a special edition of the call where we review the full year 2018 and talk a little bit about our outlook for 2019. And much like we've done the last few years, we're going to start off with just a general recap of 2018, and I'll go ahead and start it off. And I think by far the biggest headliner for 2018 was the U.S. economy. It was the best year that we've had since before the financial crisis. It looks like we're still waiting for fourth quarter data to come in, but it looks like year-over-year economic growth for the U.S. is going to be 3%. So pretty solid number compared to where we've been. We've been averaging somewhere around 2% since that 2008-2009 time frame. So really strong growth, and a lot of it was powered by tax reform and regulatory relief, as we've talked about on this call quite a bit. That was a big driver. And, you know, some of the, product of this, you know, significant economy that we've had is earnings growth. Earnings growth for S&P 500 stocks, again, we're still waiting for fourth quarter earnings to come in. But it looks like we're going to have earnings growth somewhere in the neighborhood of 25% year-over-year growth for S&P 500 stocks, which is really outstanding. And, you know, a lot of that was driven by reduced tax rates. But I think it's also important to point out that we had some pretty significant top-line growth or revenue growth. And, again, still waiting for numbers to come in. But I think there's a very good chance that we see double-digit year-over-year growth from a revenue standpoint. So, again, outstanding there. The employment data that we saw this year, we reached lows in unemployment that we haven't seen since 1969. We've had really good, strong payroll growth. We've seen wage growth for the first time in a long time. So, you know, just a lot of positives that came out of 2018 from an economic standpoint. So when you think about all those positives, then you naturally think, wow, it must have been a great year for the market. And that really, it was not the case at all, as many people are very aware. It was an incredibly difficult 2018 for stocks in general, but really for all asset classes. And Richard Chauvin later on in the call is going to get into a little bit more detail about that. But there were very, very few sub-asset classes even that were in positive territory. All of your major asset classes produced either a zero return or negative returns for the full year. And I don't think we've ever seen a year like that. A lot of volatility. There were three market corrections during the year. January, February time frame, there was a market correction. October, we saw a pretty significant pullback. And then December was the worst of all, and that's where we saw small cap stocks and the NASDAQ go down more than 20% in inner bear market territory. The S&P 500 stopped at 19%, so we didn't officially enter a bear market, but obviously a very, very difficult month for stocks. And oil prices were incredibly volatile. We were kind of looking at our topics from last year. One of the things that we talked about was Bitcoin. Bitcoin was all the rage as we entered 2018. I think it was down somewhere around 90%, and no one is calling us asking how to invest in Bitcoin anymore. So just a really incredible year. Some of that volatility that we saw in the market, I think, was definitely shaped by algorithmic or program trading, a lot of high-frequency trading, but there were also a lot of geopolitical or policy type issues that shape the year. And that's generally the case. You know, there's always policy issues that will influence the market. But I think this year it was amped up quite a bit compared to what we've seen from previous years. And I'm going to ask Paul Teaton. Good morning, Paul. Paul, are you there? You on
yes,
mute?
Good morning, Dave.
Hey.
No, I was for a second there. Thank
yeah,
you.
No problem. I think it'd be great if you can kind of just highlight some of those policy and geopolitical issues that really helped shape 2018. Paul?
Sure. Thank you, Dave. Well, as Dave mentioned, the strong U.S. economic growth had the consequence of raising the Federal Reserve's profile quite a bit to kind of a main focus of attention last year as their policymaking board, known as the Federal Open Market Committee, raised the Fed funds rate, the overnight interbank loan rate, a full percent in 25 basis point increments over the year. So really a pretty aggressive move on the Fed's part to raise short-term interest rates, which got a lot of attention in the markets. The main consensus was that getting the Fed funds rate up to 2.5% by year end in itself wasn't an acute worry point, but it was the projections for 2019 that indicated pretty much more of the same that drew a lot of concern in the fourth quarter that the Fed was really not paying sufficient attention to the potential destabilizing impact of continued aggressive policy, which included what's known as quantitative tightening, where they're rolling off their portfolio of Treasury bonds, which had an impact of putting some upper pressure on interest rates in the intermediate part of the Treasury yield curve. So the combination of raising the funds rate 100 basis points and forcing a lot of Treasury financing back into the market from the portfolio roll-off was kind of a double whammy that was a main source of concern in the fourth quarter as the markets got a bit destabilized. Other policy items were related to trade. Early in the year, there was a lot of headline and anxiety about the president indicating he wanted to terminate NAFTA and such that people were not happy with. And so eventually they basically papered over the differences and rebooted NAFTA as the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, settled some trade tariff issues with Europe, sort of, you know, put a lot of that to bed, which was the signal, as it turns out, that attention would focus on China. And as we know, those discussions got intensified, and we're now in the middle of, you know, talks with China to try to reform some of their trade practices that we find unacceptable. So that's been a pretty major worry point for the markets and was a headline dominator in the second half. The other thing geopolitical that was a risk factor that surfaced, the United Kingdom is planning to exit the European Union on March 29 is the target. But there has been a lot of anxiety about negotiating a treaty with the EU to make that exit palatable to both sides, and they really have not been able to come to agreement on that. So that's a sort of a lesser visible concern in the U.S., although potentially a big market destabilizer in Europe that's on the near-term horizon. That's a potential risk factor for our markets. And finally, in the U.S. Policy and politics realm, the Supreme Court nomination of Justice Kavanaugh in September was very messy and polarized and kind of exposed for everybody to see just how polarized politics was in the U.S. And the midterm elections I followed up on that and changed control of the House to the Democratic Party and set up the partial government shutdown that we're still dealing with. So that's the political and geopolitical roundup, Nathan.
Great, Paul. Quite a year, for sure. I've never experienced one like it in my career. Hope we don't have another one, but let's go ahead and talk about the pressing issues or what might shape 2019. And what I'm going to do is ask each of our panelists just to talk a little bit about what they think the pressing issues for 2019 will be. And Richard Chauvin, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Pressing issue for 2019, what do you think it'll be?
I think it's going to have to be the China trade dispute and efforts to end that. My comments on that are that, first of all, China's economic growth has been slowing faster than expected, somewhat as a result of the trade dispute, and some of it's just domestic reasons for that. What's interesting is that while the Trump administration is beginning its reelection campaign for the 2020 elections, both sides of the of this dispute, China and the U.S., have an incentive to get an agreement done to end this dispute. One of the more surprising developments recently that didn't get a lot of press, as far as I could see, is that China has already offered, even before these recent talks that have just ended, these 3 days of talks, China has offered to draft legislation to prevent local municipalities from creating these forced technology transfers, which is one of the important issues in the trade dispute, where U.S. Companies coming into China to do business must provide the Chinese partner with proprietary technology, which, of course, is then used against them in competition, and that's something that we consider very unfair. China apparently is offering to end that. That will be great progress if it happens. However, China has a history of saying things and then not following through, so we're going to remain skeptical about that at this point, but it would be encouraging if they follow through on that. Without some significant progress on some of these major items in the dispute, then on March 1st, President Trump has said he will escalate the current 10% tariffs to 25%, which would be a pretty painful incident for China, and it will definitely have an effect on U.S. consumers as well. So it would be painful to both, probably more painful to China if that happens. My assumption here is that there's going to be enough progress made in these talks leading up to March 1st that the 25% tariff will not get implemented then. It will get delayed, but there will still be some unresolved issues that are going to likely take much longer to resolve. You know, it could take months. It could take longer than that. Therefore, the negative of that is that the uncertainty over the tariff rate will continue, and that has some negative consequences we'll get into a little bit later. Those are my comments, Dave.
Yeah, I don't think anybody will disagree that trade will continue to be an important issue in 2019. Greg, what else do you think will be pressing for 2019?
In my mind, I think U.S. economic growth and corporate earnings. Regarding growth, I think that U.S. growth actually is sustainable in the midst of global slowing. Granted, it may be at a slightly slower rate of change than we've seen over the past year, but my reasoning is this. The U.S. economy is vast relative to most other economies, and more of our growth is driven by internal factors rather than global factors. If you take a look at our exposure of global trade to GDP or gross domestic product, it's about 13%, while globally across countries it averages about 30%, implying other countries are going to really feel more of the pain and impact of an economic slowing. We're in a sense a very isolationist economy just because of our size. So U.S. economies, obviously with sectors and larger international exposures, will feel some more direct impact of it. But overall, I think we sit in a pretty good position still. On the earnings front, it looks like at the moment, and I'm looking at FactSet, which is one of our research providers to the for our audience. They estimate that earnings growth rate for calendar year 2019 will be around 8%. Now, that's obviously far below the 20-25% that we're probably going to come in with, but that's coming off a pretty low base. And if you look at that in a historical context, of course, we've got to see what the earnings report will come in, but 8% is still a pretty healthy growth rate. In fact, I looked at the average growth rate historically going back to about 1985, and 8% is right about in the median range. So it's a lot less than what we've seen, but again, we're right in a pretty sweet spot, I think, from an overall historical standpoint.
Great. Thank you, Greg.
Sure.
Jeff Tangus, what are your thoughts? Most pressing issue for 2019?
Well, I think it'll be a one of the same issues that was a big issue in 2018, which was the Federal Reserve and what will they be doing with all of their various tools that they have to control interest rates and the economy. Two things that they did in this in 2018 was quantitative tightening, which was their way of reducing the Fed balance sheet and basically putting some Treasury securities back into the market. And then the second thing, of course, is raising the Fed funds rate. Jay Powell has learned a lot of good lessons in his relatively short tenure here as the Fed chair. He's learned one thing that all Fed chairs seem to learn at some early point in their career, and that is that you really don't want to make any flippant comments or anything that's not a very calculated comment to the markets, because the market is hypersensitive to things, which is one of the things that caused a lot of our risk-off sell-off in the markets, in both the stock and bond markets in December, or the fourth quarter of 2018. So the Fed is going to be a large factor, maybe, and hopefully not as large a factor as they were in 2018. The Fed has kind of gotten religion and come out and said that they are going to be much more data dependent and flexible when it comes to their interest rate increases, as well as quantitative tightening. So the Fed has still said that the economy is good, that they're watching all of the relevant things that they would typically watch: inflation, the labor force, the dollar, interest rates around the world, the trade dispute, even watching what's happening with the government shutdown. But essentially, the Fed has said that they are going to take a much more flexible view of Fed policy and not be quite as disruptive, hopefully, in 2019 as they were in the latter part of 2018.
Okay. That'll be definitely something for us to monitor, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it in calls in the future. Paul, why don't we wrap up with you? Most pressing issue for 2019.
Well, I think for both the stock and the bond markets, Europe and how they handle Brexit is going to be a near-term factor and potential source of risk and instability. Basically, the UK exit from the EU, known as Brexit, is scheduled to happen on March 29. And we just don't know how that's going to play. It's just not clear. It's probably about a 50-50 choice between something that's sort of a firecracker that did not go off or something pretty disruptive. It's hard to tell. I tend to lean toward that they're going to find a way to skate by chaos. And maybe that just means that they walk away from the whole Brexit concept. That's just remains to be seen, but that's a near-term risk that we'll deal with over the next couple of months. And related to that, the European Central Bank has projected that they're going to emulate our Federal Reserve, more or less, in moving away from quantitative easing, which they've already done. They've terminated that program, and begin to raise short-term interest rates, which are still negative in Europe, up towards zero sometime this summer. So it's pretty unlikely that that happens if Europe is in chaos due to a messy, disruptive Brexit. But if they can finesse that somehow, that would clear the way for the ECB to move towards their normalization agenda, which would have pretty significant implications for probably push global interest rates up, would increase our bias for higher interest rates. But on the other hand, if they fail to do that for whatever reason, most likely growth slowing in Europe due to Brexit or otherwise, the market will definitely punish the euro. The dollar would appreciate 5 or 10% at least, which would become a risk for U.S. manufacturers, basically pricing them out of world markets. So we're keeping a close eye on Brexit and the ECB this year.
All right. Thank you, Paul. So, again, as usually the case, no shortage of issues that may shape the market. And we're going to give you an outlook on what we think is going to happen in the stock market and the bond market. But before we do that, I thought it would be appropriate for us to kind of just review some of the performance data for 2018 as it related to different asset classes. So I'm going to ask Richard Chauvin just to give us a broader view of the best, which I guess is going to be bonds, I'm guessing, Richard, somewhere around zero. I never thought of the best would be at zero, but I guess that's
yes,
the year it's been, and then talk about some of the not-so-happy news. So, Richard.
Okay. I'll start with the relatively good news, which in a normal year would be not too exciting. So we said before that this was a year where there was little or no place to hide in terms of diversifying your portfolio to make money or prevent yourself from losing value. So the best performers in 2018 were, first of all, cash, which earned almost 2%. Being in cash was a successful place to be. I also noted that if you were in municipal bonds, you did hold some value there. The Bloomberg Barclays Municipal Bond Index was up about 1.3%, a positive number. Intermediate bonds, which is where a lot of investors tend to park bond portfolios, was basically flat or earned about 1 basis point or 0.01%. Longer-term government bonds were actually down if you own long treasuries, for example, you lost about 1.8% due to the general rise in interest rates over that period. Not so positive were the equity or the riskier asset classes. We talk about the ACWI index, the all country world index, down 9.4% for the year. That's a global equity index. U.S. large caps down about 4.4%. U.S. small caps down about 11%. What we call the EFA, or the Developed Markets International Index, down 13.3%. And emerging market stocks had a particularly bad year, down 14.5% for the year. And I'll wrap up with commodities, generally dominated by the energy markets. The broad commodity index is down 13.8. So it was a particularly negative year, particularly if you were in the risky asset classes. Dave, that's a good wrap-up there.
Great. No place to hide. So now that we're hopefully putting 2018 behind us, let's go ahead and talk about asset class performance for 2019, and we'll start with the stock market. So, Greg, you heard kind of from a bigger picture some of the return information. Why don't you share for us just a brief year in review for the equity markets, a little performance data, and then we're going to have both the bearish outlook case and the bullish outlook case. So, Greg, I'll turn it over to you.
All right, thanks, Dave. Yeah, it was surprising the way the market behaved last year, given the number of positive things going on in the economy, which I think we're all in agreement. And as you said, GDP should come in around 3% for the first time in a decade. The unemployment rate ended the year at 3.7%, which is the lowest rate since 1969. Wage growth grew at more than 3% for the first time since 2009. More than 2 million jobs were created last year. And these are just a few of the positive economic developments. In retrospect, the market in 2017 seemed to be bulletproof. Even a potential nuclear conflict with North Korea couldn't shake the market, but 2018, things changed dramatically. As you said, we had three large pullbacks in stock prices throughout the year, and many of the geopolitical events that existed in 2017 carried over into 2018, and in all likelihood, made a, you know, some contribution to the rise in volatility. There were concerns, again, about the Federal Reserve raising rates too aggressively, President Trump's escalation of rhetoric regarding protectionist trade policies and tariffs, how long or how much longer can the economic expansion last, a strengthening dollar and potential slowing in China and Europe. Market behavior seemed to belie the good numbers the economy was producing. The sell-off in late January, in my opinion, in late January and early February, in my opinion, was really a correction waiting to happen. After a solid 2017 in the markets, prices really started an upward trajectory that implied this market is moving a bit too fast. Consequently, as the market approached late January, we experienced our first decline of 2018 that continued into February. In the latter half of the year, the escalating trade rhetoric between President Trump and China became a more dominant concern for the markets, in my opinion, as well as the valuations and the price-to-perfection nature of the tech companies that have been driving a lot of the market indexes for quite some time, also better known as the FANG stocks or some variation of those FANG stocks, which Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, and some of the others, they've expanded that list of tech names. But some of the tech stocks for the quarter came in a little light in their earnings and sales reports, and I don't think any of them were really particularly significant, what I remember, but it seemed to precipitate the decline that we experienced in October. Then enter December. With the possibility of 25% tariffs, more talk of that at least, in addition to increasing signs that the global economy as well as the U.S. economy could slow down in 2019, it appeared too much for the markets to digest, and fear of the future overwhelmed investors, and we experienced our third pullback in stock prices in 2018. But, and this is going to echo a little bit of what Richard just said, but just to illustrate how difficult it was to make money in the volatile security markets, in a study by Ned Davis Research, again, one of our research providers, and it was titled Few Places to Hide, looked at eight different asset classes, going back to 1972, covering domestic stocks, international stocks, REITs, commodities, government, corporate bonds. And the conclusion was none of those asset classes last year produced a return equal to or greater than 5%. And we haven't seen an environment like that since, I think, 1972, since the study. And, again, looking at the Dow Jones indices and some of the performance numbers, and Richard did go through some of that, it's all red. It's all negative with the exception of a few bond indices, and Richard pointed that out. There's some muni and some treasury bond indices that were actually slightly positive for the year, but everything else was, again, down. And U.S. was actually in a much better position compared to the rest of the globe, because if you look at the international equity indices, and we're talking developed, emerging, frontiers, those were all down double digits, while most of us were down single digits. So we were actually in a little bit better position. In terms of sectors, the only three sectors, well, actually probably the two that had any significant positive performance at the end of the year were the defensive sectors of healthcare and utilities. Consumer discretion, it was barely up over zero, but everything else was negative. And the big losers, of course, were energy, which was down about 18% on the year. So going forward, what I think we need to do, you know, amongst all the geopolitical concerns, we need some kind of catalyst that calms the markets. I think probably some forward progress on trade would do a lot of good for the markets, and probably the Fed's most recent comments talking about how they're not necessarily committed to continue to aggressively raise interest rates. Just those comments recently by Powell, we saw the market rally. So I think those are some positive things that could happen in the future, Dave.
Okay, great, Greg. Thank you. As a firm, I think it's worth noting that we are fairly positive on stocks, particularly U.S. stocks. We entered the year with an overweight in that particular asset class. And instead of talking about it in terms of bearish terms and bullish terms, it might be appropriate, Richard, to maybe outline some of the reasons or what may occur to where that forecast or that outlook isn't right, or the bearish case. Richard?
Yes, here's a bearish case that I want to present just to have the audience kind of think about all the things that could go wrong, not that they will, but here's the scenario I would like to lay out briefly here. So let's assume that global growth, which has begun to slow in 2018, continues to slow with China and Europe sort of leading that trend. The U.S. and China trade dispute continues to drag on, while the 90-day period that's up on March 1st, where the tariff rate is 10%, gets extended. No substantial deal emerges from that extension. So in the second half of the year, Trump, you know, remains true to his pledge and raises tariffs on China to 25%. China continues to try to stimulate its economy, as it's been doing pretty regularly here over the past number of months. But at the same time, it has a government reform agenda that involves corruption, anti-corruption efforts, and credit restrictions. So it tries to do both things at once, which is very difficult, and its economy continues to decelerate, slow down from the current rate, which we think is around maybe 6.5%. This slowing of China, given the size of their economy, harms the other emerging market economies, and it also, as does the U.S. dollar, which continues to rise as it did in 2018. And since the emerging market, with the exception of China, without China, is a particularly large influence on the trade-weighted dollar, about 34% of that index. So the dollar strength has a pretty negative effect on those many EM countries that have a lot of dollar-denominated debt. So as Paul alluded to, we're assuming here that no Brexit deal is arrived at, despite all the efforts, and that the Brexit occurs with no deal, and therefore the worst fears of the EU officials and of many in positions of power in Europe wring their hands over this, because with no deal, there's sort of bedlam and sort of no guidepost. And with that environment, the European Central Bank decides that its plan to normalize rates, as Paul discussed, has to be delayed. Unfortunately, then, investors around the globe see this decision by the ECB as a vote of no confidence in Europe's ability to thrive without any extraordinary assistance. This creates a more severe risk-off environment in global markets, and fears of deflation grow again as they once did during the European debt crisis back in 2011. Then the weakness in the euro adds more fuel to the rising dollar, and that hurts U.S. manufacturers that depend on exports of their products. Begin to lay off U.S. workers, and then the U.S. labor market, which has been so strong, begins to show signs of weakness. And this just fuels more recession fears in the U.S., and the market declines in reaction to those pieces of evidence that, indeed, the U.S. economy seems to be showing some cracks. So in this particular scenario, both foreign mistakes, policy mistakes in Europe, and domestic issues such as trade policies that harm U.S. and China precipitate a more significant bear market in U.S. stocks. So I'll wrap it up there, and that's the things that we think could go wrong, and don't think that they necessarily all will, but these are things that we have to keep in mind. Dave?
Yep, all good points, Richard. So, Paul, maybe address some of those head-on if you could, but really talk a little bit more about why we have a positive outlook on stocks or the bullish case for 2019.
Sure. Thank you, Dave. Well, the bull case for U.S. equities in 2019 starts with our view that the U.S. economy should continue to grow at least at moderate rates, and there are no signs otherwise at this point, although perhaps growth might be a little slower than the robust 3% growth we saw in 2018, maybe something on the order of around 2.5%. But importantly, the headwinds and volatility that plagued the equity markets in recent months were largely about policy uncertainties that we expect will begin to be resolved favorably in the months ahead. The U.S. housing market is soft due to higher mortgage rates, but is not overbuilt. Auto sales have plateaued at a high level, and the used car market is saturated, but there are not many signs of instability, overpriced assets, or excessive leverage in the private sector economy. The main driver of economic growth is strong employment, and that is driving healthy growth in real disposable income and consumer spending. We think corporate earnings growth will decelerate in 2019 from the astounding 20% plus growth rates in 2018, which was a function of the tax reform implemented a year ago, but to rates that are still healthy in a 5 to 10% range. Price earnings ratios, valuation measures that came down in 2018 due to that earnings growth are cheaper still now after the recent correction and represent compelling value. Tax reform and repatriated earnings have strengthened U.S. corporate balance sheets, enabling a more optimistic view towards hiring and capital spending. Stock buybacks will likely continue at a robust pace, which is the invisible hand of capitalism that allows the market to determine optimal capital allocation and fund the most promising ventures. The Fed will continue to emphasize the pause in rate hikes and articulate a cautious approach to quantitative easing, dependent on global growth and market stability, possibly even including explicitly dialing back projections for quantitative easing this year. The Fed has achieved a great deal in its normalization agenda and should take a bow. The Fed funds rate is higher than inflation trends and expectations in a still underutilized economy, and it's an appropriate time for the Fed to pause and reassess. A benign, neutral, and vigilant Fed is the market's friend. On trade, the U.S. and China will reach enough agreement on trade negotiations to forestall the escalation of tariffs set for March 1, which would be well received by the equity markets. Longer term, intellectual property protections, industrial espionage, and coercive regulations have to be resolved favorably to the U.S. China has too much to lose, that is, a $400 billion annual trade surplus with the U.S., and this will be President Trump's primary agenda in the next 2 years. The global supply chain is on the move away from China, and we expect a significant migration of sensitive technology production to come home to the U.S., spurring a modest boomlet in capital spending. Amazon and Apple announcing multiple new campuses in the U.S. is a telling weather vane in this context. Europe is the potential fly in the ointment in the U.S. bull case, with Brexit on the immediate horizon and no agreed exit framework in place that would avoid a disruptive collapse in cross-border trading between the U.K. and the continent. Public opinion is highly polarized in the U.K., with a bifurcated distribution on the outcome preferences about evenly split between the Remain contingent and the Leave contingent, which is increasingly willing to tolerate a hard Brexit and let the chips fall where they may. The one thing that unites Brits on this question is that they all despise the proposed treaty Prime Minister May negotiated with the EU. As the intimidating uncertainty of Brexit approaches, with no acceptable exit deal in place on March 29, policymakers in the UK are likely to coalesce to the Remain position and withdrawal of the Brexit petition. That would be a big relief to the markets, refocus attention to the Eurozone growth prospects, and open the door for the ECB to begin to move toward normalization and nudge interest rates higher in Europe this summer. The stronger euro that would result will keep a lid on the dollar and be a green light for global growth prospects, particularly those in the emerging markets. The bull case maintains there is little usefulness in analyzing the rancorous and polarized state of U.S. politics, only to state that nothing of much consequence is likely to occur legislatively this year or next with this gridlocked Congress. The already obnoxious noise level is likely to escalate as the year progresses and the 2020 presidential nomination campaigns take shape. President Trump will stick to his agenda and attempt to gain favorable positioning for re-election. China offers a rich target in that respect, as discussed. We appear destined to discover how long the government can function with the IRS, air traffic control, TSA, Border Patrol, and other Homeland Security on furlough. That the current shutdown argument is about $2 or $3 billion out of a $4 trillion budget tells us that the argument is not about money, but about political positioning. It would be better if these political squabbles retreated out of view to smoke-filled rooms, but the irritant is not likely to impede a strong rally in U.S. equities this year, with several other key market catalysts turning positive. I guess in summary, Dave, I'll say that the main difference between the bear case Richard articulated and what I've laid out here is really different directions on both trade and Brexit. If both go poorly, the bear case is likely to be the main event, and if they turn positive, as I'm suggesting is certainly plausible, we'll have a better outcome that we're positioned for this year.
Great. Well, let's hope for some good outcomes on those two fronts. Jeff Tangus, you just got a few minutes left here. If you could maybe just outline the outlook for 2019 on bonds and interest rates.
Sure, Dave. Gladly. We touched on it already in our discussion of the Fed. The Fed certainly plays such a large role in what interest rates are doing in the United States. But essentially, we had a huge rally in Treasury yields in the fourth quarter of 2018. If the markets, stock market and the bond markets, return to normal, and we see some of the optimism that Paul talked about, where the economy fundamentally continues to chug along, we could easily see longer-term interest rates, as evidenced by the 10-year, moving back up to the range where they were back in the middle of the year, somewhere maybe topping out in the 3.25% to 3.5% range sometime during 2019. So that's the longer end of the curve. The shorter end of the curve, because of what we've said with the Fed, will not be quite as active in 2019 as they were in 18. The short end doesn't move up nearly as much. So the net result is we get a more normal looking curve, a very flat curve, but not inverted, not one that necessarily indicates recession. So in a lot of respects, we're returning to something of a more normal relationship in the bond markets. And so given that, our moderately defensive policy, model portfolio policies will continue to emphasize higher quality on the credit side and then also a little short on the duration side so that we're defensive against rising longer-term interest rates. Not a year that we would expect rates to rise dramatically, but one where we think that certainly the bias will be towards rates drifting higher, especially on the long end.
All right. Thank you very much, Jeff. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. Hopefully we'll have a very prosperous 2019. going forward on our calls, we'll get back to our monthly call, 30-minute call, where we review more current situation opposed to a longer-term outlook like we did this morning. That call is going to be on February 5th. Thanks for joining, and hope to talk to you soon. Thank you.